in association with Newsarama. Welcome again to Word Balloon, the comic book conversation show. This is John Sundress. On this edition, we speak with writers Christina Weir and Nunzio De Filippis on their only prequel to the film Jumper. Also, they'll talk about their runs on Checkmate, New Mutants, and their television adventures writing for the HBO series Arliss. We'll also discuss their American manga works like Destiny's Hand and The Amazing Age of Luna coming from Seven Seas, plus new projects from Oni around the way. And Nunzio continues to teach a course on comic book writing at the UCLA Extension, and we'll also give you information if you're in the LA area about how to apply for the course. But first, the conversation begins with a look at the latest release from De Filippis and Weir, the Oni prequel to the film Jumper. I want to start with Jumper. Have you seen the movie?
We sadly have not seen the movie because we've been a little bit housebound and haven't been able to get out. So we've been relying on hearing other people's reviews and stuff of it. I'm sad that we haven't gotten a chance to see it because we read a draft really, really early on. And from all our discussions with Stacey Mays over at Fox and everything, yeah, I know it's changed entirely.
Really?
So I'm curious.
We were kept in the loop about some of these changes because we needed to make sure the story we were telling meshed with what they were doing. There would be points in which we would write and we'd say, and this will feed directly into the scene, and we'd be citing something that was in the script, the feature script, and Stacey Mays would say, oh, that scene's been cut. And so we wanted to see it. What's interesting is, you know, the things that people are responding well to in the movie were things that were in the script we thought, oh, that's really cool. And the criticisms that have been leveled against the movie were the things that when we read the script, we were like, oh, yeah, you know, they need to strengthen the lead character's motivation, make him a little more likable. You know, so like it seems that no matter how many changes the script went through, the good stuff stayed good and the bad stuff seems to have stayed bad, which is unfortunate.
On paper, it does sound like a cool concept and it does scream franchise. And now I wonder, based on performance, what are they going to do?
Well, you know, the thing is, it made okay money. It's hard these days with the way box office explodes and this weird pattern now that if a movie drops 60% from week one to week two, that's to be expected. Because,
mm-hmm.
you know, when they first started reporting box office returns, which I've never understood why as an audience we need to know, but, you know, when you talk about the big blockbusters that set this all in motion, you know, the Star Wars movies, things like that, they would never drop off 50, 60% from one week to the next. But now it's all loaded to make all of its money up front, and if
yes.
it drops off, so be it. And so it was the number one movie for a couple weeks in a row, so they may honestly look at it as a success, despite the mixed, at best, reviews.
Mm-hmm.
But there's so much potential there for a franchise. It's
a cool world. I mean, they've got
cool
all this
world.
Great material to work with.
And a lot of what we were asked to do was, and there was an interview I read that Doug Liman had said that he had not been, you know, he'd been consulted on the comic stuff, but Simon Kinberg, who did read our stuff and was sending notes back to us, that Simon was much more on top of that stuff. But what Doug had said was, when he made the movie, he wanted to just skip the boring parts. But the unfortunate side effect of that is you don't get to flesh out all the cool corners of the universe that way.
Yep.
And that he saw the comic books function as doing that. And that seems to be what they asked us to do. I mean, I think the producers knew that they had this rich stuff with the paladins and what it takes to become one and how hard it is to make your peace with killing children, basically. And they wanted us to look at that stuff.
Well, and it fit your guys' kind of storytelling, interesting adventure stories, but with very real characters. And I think, you know, Skinwalker's a perfect example of that. It's great that there is something about when you guys work with Brian Hurt. I really think, you know, he brings out the best in you guys, and he's awesome as well. And it's always a good production, and it's always an interesting book, and it's always a beautiful book. And honestly, I'm not being nice, because I wasn't crazy about the film, but I really did enjoy the book, and I really do recommend people who, you know, enjoy Jumper, and even people who didn't, I would say seek out the book, because it's a fun book, and there's a framework there for a very interesting franchise if, you know, they make their proper corrections and if the story is fleshed out.
I was just going to add for a second then that if you enjoyed the book, on the DVD when that comes out, they asked us to do a one-shot story for that. We we did a comic that Brian drew, and then they're animating it for the DVD.
Oh, that's great.
So there'll be a new story on that, so you should check that out as well.
Very cool.
It's another sort of take a one action-type moment and then turn it and focus it on another character aspect of this story that you may not have explored. You know, like in David in the movie, he has a mother who leaves home, and then he discovers he can go anywhere in the world with a thought. And in the movie, he just, you know, gets some money and starts
jumping.
Jumping and traveling and seeing the world. But to me, if my mother ran away from home when I was five and left me with an abusive father, I learned I could go anywhere in the world. The first thing I'd do is find her.
Yeah. Well, and also the whole story of the mother takes more resonance if you read the book.
Well, yeah, we had no idea. The mother was not super prominent in the script we read, but she was, from what I understand from people's reactions to the film, they've cut her even further in the film than it was in the script, so she's barely in it. So it's funny that we decided to center our story on her. I think there are some people who actually read the Jumper miniseries don't realize that that's the same character.
Well, there you go. Okay.
Because we don't get to say her name is Mary.
Right.
If we do, we give it away. We had to write the whole thing without giving away that, well, you know, if anyone's hearing this podcast, one assumes they either have seen the film or are not intending to, but that his mother is a paladin.
Well, and it's, yeah, so this is why it's an interesting idea that I think worked better in the comic book. Isn't it funny? Because how many bad comic adaptations are there of films, or just there's something missing? And I honestly think there's the reverse here. I hope the book does well. And I think you guys have cultivated a nice audience based on your books, because I'm glad Oni keeps going back to you guys, because you guys always do tell interesting stories.
And I'm glad that they do, too, because they're also the best publisher we've ever worked with in terms of letting us sort of do our own thing, but also keeping it within sort of an Oni feel. And they get us good artists. They introduced us to Brian. And you had asked about Brian earlier, and I think Brian, like, some of our best stuff is with Brian because he makes the characters real, and he's one of those artists who makes the characters act.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't have to, and you can see it in our work. Skinwalker, when we didn't know Brian, we didn't know what he was capable of, is overwritten by comparison to Three Strikes. And Three Strikes is even probably more text-heavy than Jumper. With each book that we work with Brian, we pull back a little bit, knowing that if we call for facial expressions for the characters to act, we can convey so much more.
We can really rely on his artwork. We know it's going to convey what we want it to convey.
I'm with you. No, I totally see what you're saying. That's interesting. I think Three Strikes was the first thing that I read of your guys. And then actually Skinwalker, I finally got around to last summer when I picked it up from you guys directly at the Oni table at San Diego. And I was thrilled because I had enjoyed Three Strikes so much, and it was nice to see all three of you back on or what.
It's funny because, you know, I'm very proud of Skinwalker, but it was our first comic book, and I look back at it now and I see these pages with 9 panels and, you know, 25 balloons of dialogue. I'm like, oh my God, what were we thinking?
But it's such a great story, a real X-Files story. If there are people who haven't read Skinwalker, I recommend it. You guys might wince. I still think it's a very cool book, a great concept. And again, another very interesting Oni book. And also, I know you guys have done superhero work and probably will continue to do superhero work. But as
one hopes, because the pay rate is better, so it's always easier to make a living doing the superhero work. And honestly, some of the characters are iconic and a lot of fun to play with. But at the end of the day, you always have to know it's not your story. You know, it's
sure.
Not. You're playing with someone else's toys, and so you have to follow their rules and give them what they want. And that's a challenge. It's sort of like a fun writing exercise and a well-paying one at that. But, yeah, I think there's a stronger attachment on our part to everything we do for Oni, because those are our stories from the get-go, and we can connect to them more, I think.
Well, let's do a little bit of biographical stuff. Now, the two of you are a couple and you write together. You met at Vassar?
We met at Vassar.
Very cool.
Many, many long years ago.
And started on the East Coast, and then what, you know, the hope to screenwrite? Is that what led you both to the West Coast? Or?
Yeah, I came out here to do take graduate classes. I got my master's in screenwriting at USC. And then just as I finished up, Christina moved out here, and we were roommates.
You guys worked on Arliss together?
Yeah.
And now, you, Christina, did you start on Arliss first?
I did. I was working as a writer's assistant on Arliss, and I developed a really good rapport with the writers. And somewhere around fourth season, they agreed to take a look at a spec script if I wanted to show them one. And I wrangled Nunzio to write it with me, and that was sort of the beginning of our foray into writing together.
That's really
and
cool.
They liked the script, and they hired us to do an episode season four, and then by season five, they hired us on as writers.
That's excellent. And I think Arliss was one of those shows that as it went on, it did get better as it progressed. And I you know, it's funny. I have a background in sports talk radio, and so we all watched Arliss. <You know? laughs> Because we were dealing with Arlisses all the time, man. And, you know, it was I'm a Robert Wuerl fan, and I was really interested in reading and prepping for you guys. You kind of touched on the experience of writing on Arliss, and specifically for Robert Wuerl, and it sounded like he was kind of a tough editor when it came to, you know, and understandably so. It's his show, and it's his stamp.
Oh, it's totally his baby. You know, yeah. He wrote, he directed, he was in the editing room, but he was. It was a great learning experience because you really, you know, you go into a room full of writers and you put everything out there, and you just got to sort of grit your teeth and wait to see what comes next.
There's a moment in a movie called My Favorite Year. I don't know if you've
love
ever seen
movie.
It.
Love that movie. Absolutely. Richard Benjamin movie. Absolutely.
Where they're on the comedy show, and Joe Bologna plays the star, mm-hmm. King Kaiser. And he comes in and he goes, "What is that smell? What is that awful smell?" And he picks up the script. He goes, "It's coming from here. It's the script. It sucks. Get it out of here." Robert did that in a writer's meeting. It was not one of our scripts, thankfully. But he actually did that.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. So, I mean, and the thing is, it was Robert and his writing partner on a lot of the episodes was a guy named Alan Steven, who had worked on Roseanne. And when Roseanne sort of seized control of that show for herself, he was right there by her side. And so he was doing the same thing here, where he was like the right hand to a star-driven show. Mm-hmm. And he's a stand-up comic, too, and Robert comes out of stand-up comedy. So when they don't like your stuff and they're stand-up comics, you're not only going to hear it, but you're going to hear it in a way
they're going to mock it.
Yeah, that makes the whole room laugh at you. So it was you know, these days, you know, editors are always coming back and going, "I'm sorry if that note is harsh," and we're thinking, "Are you kidding me?"
I can imagine. Yeah, it sounds like Robert Wuerl went to like the Sid Caesar School of, like, you know.
So you got to figure it just makes everything you face down the line easier.
But, I mean, I don't want to speak ill of Robert, because Robert, I mean, and think about a man who looks at his own writer's assistant and says, "Okay, what stories do you got?" and then puts her on the staff.
Yeah, that's cool. Absolutely.
I mean, he was loyal to his people. He seems like it to me anyway, and then this may be a romanticized notion, but a very old-fashioned notion of what a Hollywood type is. He pulls no punches. He would actually say, "You never cut funny," you know, those sort of pithy things that you expect Hollywood types to say. Like, but he was very loyal to his people, and he promoted from within, and we owe him a lot for that. So.
That's cool. No, that's cool. And no, I can understand that too. And coming from stand-up and stuff, yeah, I think comedians are their toughest, you know, audience. Or I always loved when someone was being sincere, but with a very straight face, "No, that's funny," and wouldn't laugh or anything, but just like, "No, that's good. Keep going."
That's funny, because that's exactly how Robert would be. If you got something that he liked, he wouldn't laugh. He wouldn't get all excited about it. Not until he put his own spin on it, and then when he would sort of pitch it to the room with his own spin, he was very excited about that. But you could tell when you got him when he would say, "Okay, yeah, keep going.
Cool.
And what else? And where else does it go?" and it really was, because like every time you'd pitch him an idea, it would be like, "Okay, so there's the setup. What's the punchline? Keep coming. Keep coming. What's going? What's going? Where's this going?" And he also had a funny way of sort of leaving the room with Alan and going to have a conversation and coming back, and your story was just completely different. We had a story once. It was what it would be like to be the son of a legend. I think it was because I think Jack Nicklaus's son was his caddy.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So what would it be like to not only just be the son of a legend, but to be in that legend's world? And so we were pitching this, you know, and we were spinning various versions, like what if you were the son of Joe DiMaggio playing baseball and he was the manager of the team or something. And then Robert goes, no, we'll stick with golf. We'll do the Jack Nicklaus thing. Then he goes for a walk, and he comes back and he goes, okay, this is how it opens. The son is holding a club talking about how hard it is, and then we pull back and see that the club is evidence in the murder case because he killed his father with it.
Oh, jeez.
And we were like, Robert, this is a comedy. You'll note that idea never became an episode.
I was going to say, which of your episodes would I have seen?
Our first episode was the
country music singer who wanted to play baseball.
Okay.
Which it's really funny because we actually, our latest foray into the world of television is we're working on a 2-hour TV movie about country music. So we've decided this is our niche in television, our sort of good luck. We'll do country music. You know?
And as anyone who's ever met us will attest, we're not really the country music demographic.
We know nothing about country music. I shouldn't admit to that, but
we can cut that part.
Oh, research.
Well, that's cool. Well, yeah, because Garth Brooks played with several teams.
Yeah, that was, I mean, and that was when we wrote the spec script for Arliss. They didn't make that episode, though the idea went on the storyboard and ultimately I think became an episode in the final season. They then said, okay, well, we're not going to make this, but they said come in and pitch ideas. And that was the one that really took with Robert because it was several months after Garth Brooks, I think.
Okay. It's funny now, too, currently Billy Crystal playing with the Yankees.
Yeah, I can't believe the negative press he got in New York papers about that. Like, the Yankees are wasting serious spring training time. And I'm like, it's spring training, and he's Billy Crystal. Come on.
Yeah, but he is 60.
Well, nobody expected him to try out for the team. It was like doing a nice thing for a guy who's a very proud Yankee fan.
That's true. No, I understand. He made 61. You got to give him that. Decent TV baseball movie. I'll cut him slack for that. You say you were on staff for the fifth season.
And sixth season.
Okay.
We wrote six episodes. The one was an arbitrated credit and whatever. But
okay.
That one wasn't our story idea. We came in afterwards and wrote the final draft, which by WGA rules pretty much means that we were going to get some credit in arbitration.
Okay.
That was not an arbitrated as in we sued anybody. It was just a case of where the writer that had hired to do it left with a first draft that Robert effectively threw out and gave back to the room. And so we redid it. Robert fought to get us the credit.
Oh, that's nice. That's really cool.
Yeah, he's really good that way. So other than that, there were five that were based on our ideas.
Okay.
Yeah.
After that, we did one, which was about...
We had two teammates, two football players who were competing for the same woman.
Oh, was that the Wichita lineman?
Yes, it was.
That was Robert's brilliant idea to put that still on the line, that song there at the end.
That was great. That was really funny.
Our big contribution to that was the whole Cyrano angle that Rita was helping the one.
Yeah, Sandro. His assistant. And it's great. Now you see, I'm talking to you about Sandro, and I talked to Alan Heinberg about Sandro on Grays. Very cool.
You could just line up a whole Sandro O series.
Yeah, and all the comic book connections to Sandro O. Who would have thought?
Just as a side note, by the way, on the jumping back to the country music episode, that episode opened with a scene of Stanley and Kirby playing Naked Twister. This was the very first thing Nunzio and I ever wrote for television. This was our big break into Hollywood. We had families back on the East Coast.
Everyone in our family
who was so excited, could not wait to see it. And there was Nunzio. What was he, 80 at the time, Nunz? Your 80-year-old group?
85.
85-year-old Italian grandmother watching the TV who doesn't understand a lot of English going, no, this can't be my Nunzio show. He wouldn't write this porn.
She actually told my aunts and uncles to change the channel because they had clearly put the wrong show on.
It's not TV, Grandpa. It's HBO.
But that was the fun of writing for an HBO show. We kept being told it's HBO. There should be more swearing and there should be more naked women.
And it was weird because they would say it whether the story needed it or not. There's a scene in that episode, I believe, later in that episode, where the the boxer's in a limo, and he's got Kirby with him, and he's got these two women. I think they were the women from the Naked Twister. So, and they're in the limo going to basically a Jack-in-the-Box type drive-thru, and they just decide the women should have no clothes on.
Well, of course.
They should just drive around in this limo topless. I think that was the ultimately they settled on topless because there are limits even for HBO. But it just, they were like, well, we're going to have this scene. They're going to go through the drive-thru. We don't have enough nudity in this episode. Let's just have the women be topless.
Yeah, but, you know, I can see that coming from the same network that gave us First and Ten. Because there was just always just insert boob shot here and everybody's like,
yeah, exactly.
There was a sense. It loosened up over as the longer we were there, the less we seemed to hear that. But when we first got there, there was definitely this mandate of we can, so we should.
Interesting. That's awesome.
I'm trying to think of what were the other ones that we did. The Bobby Knight, where Arliss is representing a Bobby Knight type basketball coach who coats his players' lockers in horse shit.
Oh, wow. Jesus.
And gets fired for it. What else is there?
We had the episode where an actor is going to play a sports agent, so he follows Arliss around trying to...
figure out
how... Well, no, that was what we pitched. It turned out he followed Kirby around.
Oh, right, right.
Because Robert had an idea for a story. He wanted to merge two stories into one episode. So he said, well, your idea is great, but put it on Kirby, and we'll do this with me. So we wound up writing that.
Okay, well, and I see that the basketball coach that was of Cabbages and Kings?
Yeah.
I'm looking at TV.com. Now, did you guys title the shows, or was...
No, Robert would. Sometimes we did. The Cult of Celebrity.
That was our title.
That was, which was the Garth Brooks baseball one. That we got to keep our title.
Okay.
When Opportunity Knocks, which wound up airing as a season finale, because apparently at the end Robert got this great idea about there was an oxygen bar scene, and Robert said, well, at the end of the episode we should all go to the oxygen bar. And I made as a just one of those you throw out a joke just to see if someone laughs at it. I said, and Arliss lights his cigar and the whole place blows up. And Robert said, perfect! And so that's how the episode ends. And so he was like, we have to put that at the end of the season. It's like our own cliffhanger.
That's outstanding.
As if anyone would believe that, you know, Arliss and company weren't coming back.
Well, as I remember, though, and maybe I'm wrong because this was the press reaction after the last couple seasons, it was always a question, is it coming back? Because it
That's actually true. It was a question every season.
So, and it had a healthy little syndication run, I know, on ESPN, and they had to cut the
boob
shots.
ESPN Classic.
I know. But they were able to keep most of it in. Seemed like an interesting cast. Man, Michael Boatman, I'm always a big fan of his.
Love Michael Boatman.
Michael Boatman, it's funny, when we were on the show, Sandra Oh is really nice to us. But Sandra, you know, she's an actress.
Sure.
And so she was always sort of immersed in the script and moving around. And so she was friendly to everybody because, well, I think, A, she's a friendly person. But, B, also just, you know, I think she wanted to know the writer. So, you know, which writer she spent the most time with was based on whose script was being shot that week, because she really wanted to know what they were thinking, you know, get her thoughts in on the script, that sort of thing. Michael seemed to gravitate towards us because Michael was a comic book fan and a science fiction fan.
Oh, that's cool.
And he knew we were writing comics because at that point we had written Skinwalker and I'd written an issue of Detective Comics.
Okay.
So he started gravitating towards us, and then Robert found out that Michael was writing a science fiction novel and he wanted to put it in as a subplot in one of the episodes that Stanley was writing a science fiction novel. And I don't think Michael took it very well that Robert wanted to make fun of it.
Oh, jeez.
Because Robert's like, this is hysterical. This is hysterical. We can, you know, and he's putting in, you know, like the kind of science fiction terminology that Douglas Adams made fun of in Hitchhikers.
Sure.
You know, like with names like Slarty Bartfest and things like that. Like, he would have the Stanley character talking about his book, and it was all this techno babble and ridiculous names, and it was just basically Robert saying, I don't understand science fiction and I don't understand people who read or write science fiction, so you're a nerd. And I don't, like I said,
I don't think Michael took it too well.
Yeah, I don't think he thought it was very funny.
That's too bad, man. Because actually, I could kind of see that would be a funny kind of dirty secret in the closet for Stanley to have that kind of.
Well, there you go. Yeah.
You know, so yeah, I can understand where Whirl is coming from, but you gotta stand up for your comic book rights. Stand up for comics, absolutely. I respect that. Well, that's cool.
I remember
cool.
the pride with which Michael Boatman told us that his kid, I think it was, turned to look to him one day and said, "Daddy, why is it Batman and Superman, but Batgirl and Supergirl?" And he was so proud
wow.
that she had figured that out. And she was pretty young back then.
Very cool.
Yeah, that's true.
And that's always something, again, going back to your comic book work, you guys do write strong women. You write very strong women.
Well, we certainly try. I think what's interesting is, in some ways, Skinwalker is a good first book for us because we got to do dual narrative, and one was male and one was female, and so it kind of brought the fact that we can, that as a male writer and a female writer working together, we can sort of grasp the two different points of view on the mm-hmm. same situation. We could, I mean, not that Attica's perspective is stereotypically female or Haworth's is stereotypically male, but in some ways it allowed us to sort of break the story up and say male story, female story, though we would then hop perspectives because we didn't want to stick to any one thing. We read a coverage once on one of our scripts, does a total tangent, mm-hmm. where someone said, they're a writing team and you can tell who wrote which parts. And what's funny is Christina and I don't split up the scripts. We never, like, I don't write half and then she writes half. There aren't, you can't read our script and say this scene was written by him and this scene was written by her.
Okay.
Yeah, we write all of it together.
Are you, is someone sitting at the word processor and the other one's pacing? And
yeah, kinda, that would be me. Nuncio's the pacer.
There you go. Yeah,
which
I'm
means
sorry.
I talk more than she does, but she controls what makes it to the page.
Indeed, that's the secret of the typer, absolutely. No, that's cool. And Christina, you ever call him on, like, was there a time when, you know, Nuncio would, like, fly something out there and you'd be like, no, a woman would never say that, or?
I'm trying to think if it's specifically a woman would never say that. There are times I've argued over, you know, that character wouldn't say that.
Okay.
I think more than Christina, I fall prey to something that I see in a lot of comic writers these days, which is, and I'm going to say this, and it's going to sound like it's aimed at him specifically, but it's not because I think he's a great writer and I'm a huge fan, Joss Whedon syndrome.
Okay.
Everyone is so clever.
I understand.
Like in Buffy, everyone is so witty in Buffy. And he does it really well in a way that lets each character, especially on Buffy, have a unique voice. And as long as you do that, they can all be clever. But Buffy imitators, Joss imitators, wind up writing things where everyone is so clever in a way that blends together. So they're, all their voices become one. And it becomes less about what would the character say and more about how clever can I make the character in this moment. And I think I fall prey to that more than Christina does, and that's what she tends to catch me on when I will have someone say something, and she will respond and say, that's not what they would say here. You're just trying to make them sound pithy.
Gotcha.
I do have perhaps one stereotypical gender sort of quirk, I think, that I've sometimes called you on where you will, like when we're trying to write a character a certain way, and you will have them be maybe crasser than I would have them be, and when it's a woman, I think I'm sometimes like, well, she wouldn't be that crass, and I fall prey to that stereotype.
Now, there's one specific Oni book that I want to point out because it had to have been autobiographical, and that's Maria's Wedding.
Yeah. I don't know what you're talking about.
Well, there you go. I'm just kind of, you know, figuring that, you know, there had to have been some family wedding where, go ahead and tell the story if you would.
Well, this was based on, I'm loath to say it was directly based on things that happened in my family. The thing is, it's very clearly, like, things happened in my family, and I set out to write a story before Christina and I were writing together. I wrote it as a screenplay that really sucked. But I set out to write my take on it.
Okay.
And as I said, the screenplay kind of sucked, and when we started writing together, we talked about revisiting the script as a film, and we couldn't really break it as a film, and somehow we got it in our head, this would make a really good comic. And I'm not sure when that transition happened, but that's when the story started to work. And so it's very much based on these events, but the more we realized we had to write a story, the more we made it
there were dramatic, you know, licenses we needed to take and things we needed to put in to make it really flow as a story.
Okay. And we discovered the curse of writing about your life is that the people in your life, they don't tend to appreciate it. and there's this weird dichotomy because the stuff that's true, you shouldn't have revealed. And the stuff that you took license with, it didn't happen that way. So
how you can't win.
Yeah. So if you fictionalize it, you're bastardizing the story. But if you stick to the truth, you're revealing the truth about people who may not want to have their truth revealed.
Wow.
Yeah. The shocking thing when we did that for me wasn't because the general gist of it is my brother married another man,
okay,
and half of my father's side of the family, Italian. You know, my aunts,
sure,
and uncles are all first-generation immigrants. And, you know, half the family, and again, half's probably exaggeration, but there was a chunk of the family that didn't want to go, and there were specific members of the family who tried to encourage other members to skip it as some sort of sign of protest.
I understand.
And I spoke at my brother's wedding, and all I said at my brother's wedding was, look at all the people who did come. This is your real family. The other people are irrelevant.
I get you.
That's all I said. What we took as the premise of the story was, what if I took it one step further? What if I said, they're irrelevant, and the next time I see them, I'm going to tell them that. So this was the next wedding where everybody is dreading my character speaking, but yet they're all kind of secretly hoping he will because it'll bring everything up that needs to be said.
That's true.
And the thing was, it's based right there on a fiction. I didn't go that far. I didn't promise to tell anyone off. While I am outspoken, I'm not that confrontational in my family. But when the minute we made the decision to make that the premise, the character changed from me to become the outspoken one. And I have two brothers who are probably far more outspoken than I am, which will shock people like Greg Rucka, who think that I'm way too outspoken in the first place. So my brothers read this and they think, oh, he's saying he's the political one. Oh, he's saying he's the one with the courage. And they start thinking that I'm somehow insulting them. And so I was expecting that if my aunts and uncles who skipped the wedding read this, they'd be offended because I depict them as bad guys.
I understand.
But it was actually the people closest to me who were like, that's not how it happened, and you made this about you. And then it was my parents who said, some of that stuff you said about your aunts and uncles, you shouldn't have never revealed that because that stuff was true. And poor Christina's just sitting there going, wasn't me.
But early on, it was a great way to learn all the members of his extended family. That's how, it was like a homework lesson for me going, oh, okay, that's that aunt and that uncle. And
yeah, for the first few family gatherings that she went to as we were working on this, she was worried she was going to refer to my aunts and uncles by their
character names. Yeah.
Nice. And again, really interesting, unique take for a comic book story. And of course it comes from Oni because that's the kind of books that Oni normally does anyway.
Exactly.
I think that's neat. Now, we mentioned Rucka, and I'm glad you did because Greg's the guy that got you guys into the comic book writing.
Yeah, well, you know, you said that the two of us, Christina and I, met at Vassar, but I also met Greg Rucka at Vassar,
okay,
and Jennifer Van Meter. And so we all knew each other back then, though Christina knew Greg. I don't think she knew Jen that well.
Okay.
Greg and I have been pretty much best friends since sophomore year in college, which takes
it was freshman year.
Freshman year, actually, yeah.
Wow.
Second semester of freshman year. So the beginning of 1988, that's
Holy
how
cow.
Long he and I have been best friends.
Wow.
And so there isn't anything that we do writing-wise that we don't discuss with him at one point or another.
Okay.
And Skinwalker was going to be, well, first, Greg had gotten into comics, and they were doing Officer Down, and Officer Down was a crossover, and they were looking for writers to do chapters, and
this was in
Greg,
this was in the Batman titles when Commissioner Gordon was shot.
Yes.
Okay.
And Greg pulled me in, and this was before Christina and I started to write comics together, and just about when we had started to write television. So I got this job, and I said, you know, you don't like comics as much as I do. You don't want to write comics. I'm going to do this. but we'll write television and films together. And so I did the issue of Detective, and then we started plotting our next feature script, and that was going to be Skinwalker.
Okay.
And we told Greg what the idea was, and he said, you're better off making that a comic, and Oni is exactly the place for that kind of story. So suddenly Christina was writing comics, and this was early in her comics education where she had just really started to read comics a lot and start to appreciate it. So I came into it being a comic reader who had never written a comic script until that Detective. But
I had to do my homework and brush up on the whole world of comics and everything.
Like, she had to learn how to write comics at the same time she was learning the language of how to read comics.
Sure. Well, and where, Christina, where did you go to learn, and both of you really, to learn the craft of writing comics?
That would be Mr. Gregory Rucka.
Oh, from Greg. Okay.
The first comic I read was Whiteout, and
very cool.
I enjoyed it so much. I was like, okay, I'm going to give this comic thing a try. Nuncio, tell me what comics I should read, which was a big mistake. He started pulling out all of his favorite comics from the 80s. I got, the Booster Gold and the old Justice League from then.
Sure. Not necessarily a good primer.
Yeah, I understand that.
But in my defense, I also gave her The Watchmen.
Good.
He did.
Which, again, that's good classic comic. I'm not sure it should be your second or third comic you ever read. But a friend of hers had already introduced her to
Astro City.
Oh, that's great.
I loved Astro City. That was a lot of fun to read. It came from, the reading that I did. And then, Greg let us look at his scripts so we could see format and that sort of thing. And I think after that, a lot of it was sort of trial and error. There's a sense that because it's a visual medium, there is definitely some similarities to doing television and film mm-hmm. that there is to doing comics, but there's also obviously huge differences, just, even down to the fact of you have to worry about, where a page ends as opposed to, a page of a TV script that's sort of flexible in terms of how much time it takes or whatever. But, knowing that it's like I'm starting a scene at the top of this page and is it going to end at the bottom or do I have to have the perfect point for the page turn? And that you kind of just get the feel for, I think, as you go.
Well, and, that's always my question because it would seem like, figuring out those beats, where do you know in a story where all of a sudden you have to say, it's been three pages and they're still talking, something has to happen here. Do I move it up or even the idea of, hey, this needs a splash page, to really kind of show a moment of action as opposed to a bunch of a sequence of panels showing, cool action.
Right.
Those kinds of judgment calls.
Well, we have changed how we write dramatically. When we started, it was, what you need to do in the course of the story. Now go and do it.
Okay.
And then you go forward and then you realize that the scene that you just wrote is two pages too long and you're running out of room and things like that. And then you start editing and compressing and there's a lot of rewriting in that process. And the biggest problem with the rewriting that goes on there is that you may have created plenty of good stuff and how to keep it is hard. Or you may have created plenty of stuff that you think is good that you will cling too hard to thinking you need to keep it. We have now changed that. We are very meticulous plotters now. We break everything down in absolute detail before we write anything. We will do a page breakdown of a comic script or a chapter of a story or whatever it is that we're doing where we know where every page begins and where every page ends before we write a single panel.
Okay.
If we're doing a larger graphic novel, what we tend to do is we say, okay, we need to be at this point on this page, and then we'll break down that first 30 pages. And so when we're done, if we happen to run long, we still know we have room to give later, but we won't write those first 30 pages until all 30 of them are mapped out. Like, this is, so we know which ones are going to be splashes. We know where the transition. Someone is at our door.
It's okay. Yeah, yeah.
so we know where the transitions are going to be.
Okay.
And we'll say, this scene can only be three pages, and we will allocate three pages to it. So, but it's funny because this is now what I am teaching, is this absolutely meticulous form of plotting, and it's, you can see it in my students' faces. it scares them. What you're doing on page 23 before you even write page one.
So is it the beats of the, like, is it the outline? How would you say
what
this?
We do, I'll put it this way. I am teaching a class on comic writing. The process that I have them do is I first have them come up with the idea. Then they determine the format for the idea. Is it in floppy issues or is it a graphic novel?
Okay.
Once we know that, we know what they're going to write as their final project for the class. Is it going to be the first chapter of a graphic novel, if it has chapter breaks, or is it going to be the first 25 pages, or is it going to be the first issue of whatever it is that they're writing? Once they know that, then we can apply a page count to, particularly if it's an individual issue, 24, if it's an independent style idea, 22, if it's a superhero idea.
Okay.
And then what I do is I say, okay, what do you want to happen in this first issue? And they come up with the story, and we break it into scenes. How many scenes do you have here? Is this too much for a first issue? Is it too little for a first issue? Once they do that, then I have them apply page counts to it. About how many pages do you think this scene will be, this scene will be, this scene will be? And they have always flexibility. You know, if you think it's going to be 2 to 3 pages here, well, if it's 3, you've allocated. But if it's only 2, you now have an extra page to give to a later scene, that kind of thing.
I see.
And then finally from there, I have them do a page breakdown where they literally say, okay, that first scene is 3 pages long. Which beats of that scene are going to be in the first page? Which beats of that scene are going to be on the second? Which beats are going to be on the third? Because the thing that we've discovered in writing is knowing what beat to make a page turn or a page ender is the thing you can do. Like, when you figure that out, you will be thinking your stories in terms of comics.
I understand.
No other, you know, as Christina said, no other form of writing really does that. You can get a television show, and you can be told at 48 minutes into it, you're done. It's 48 minutes without, you know, once you take the commercials out.
Right.
And we have 6 acts, so this first act really needs to be exactly 12 minutes. Or 6 acts, you wouldn't get that far. But a classic four-act structure on television, 12 minutes each.
Mm-hmm.
So you're going to have to make those scenes fit 12, 12, 12, 12 because they don't like the commercial break going to different points.
Sure.
But that's as close as you get to having to adhere to a rigid structure. When you write a comic, if you choose the wrong beat to end a page on, if you have a climactic moment and then a panel afterwards, and then you turn the page, you've killed that moment. That moment is best suited at the bottom of a page or being a splash page or whatever it is. So you have to think in terms of individual pages, not a 3-page scene, but actually a scene that is 3 individual pages. What moment in that scene ends each page becomes the strongest barometer of whether that scene is going to be as appealing as you want it to be.
And that last panel should be, as you say, the prelude to a massive moment, triggering in the reader the need to flip the page.
Right. It either needs to have the suspense of what's going to happen, turn the page, or the wrap-up so that when you start the next page and then there's
a new scene.
You really feel like that page wrapped up that scene.
I understand.
One or the other, depending on whether you're continuing the scene or not.
Have you started to experiment with panel design? Because, you know, you think of, you know, there's the traditional grid structure of, on the average, aren't you talking about maybe 4 or 5 panels a page, really?
Well, you know, if you're in an American comic with the larger page size, because, you know, in the class, we also discuss manga.
Okay.
And certainly in manga, you want to stay 3, 4, 5, because the page size is so small.
Okay.
And, you know, now that we're writing for Oni and they reproduce our graphic novels at smaller sizes, we try to keep the panel count down.
Okay.
You can go higher than 5 in an American comic. The problem is so much of the market now is dominated by these powerhouse artists, and these new artists are trying to draw like the powerhouse artists.
Sure.
And if you don't give them the panel space for the images, they're not always happy with that. They're not doing their best work. There's a certain the more panels you add to a page, smaller the panel will be, the less detail can be shown in that panel.
Sure.
So unless you're working with, you know, George Perez, who could take a teeny tiny panel, one of 15 on a Crisis on Infinite Earth thing, and put 60 different members of the Legion of Superheroes, all of which you can recognize without a line of dialogue to point them out. Unless you have that artist, you got to be careful about your panel count.
I got you. That's cool.
I guess, as Christina said, Skinwalker, 9, 10 panels a page with 20 lines of dialogue or caption boxes in there. Like, there's no room for art.
We used to hear it a lot on New X-Men. They wanted us to keep panel count down.
Okay. And who was your artist for that? That was the Tsunami line.
Who was our artist for that? That's an interesting question.
Spin the wheel.
I believe at the grand total when we were done, we had 12 different artists?
13 artists.
Wow.
13 artists. If you count the Hellions miniseries, and you go from New Mutants to New X-Men to the Hellions miniseries.
Okay.
We had a yearbook special to wrap up our run on New X-Men, and you throw that one in there. You're now talking about 36 issues, 13 artists.
Wow.
We couldn't even get an artist on average of three issues per artist.
Wow. You can wear the badge of honor because I think everyone who was part of the Tsunami line, a lot of you guys are still in the game. I mean, it's Kirkman, it's you, I'm starting to blank on some of the others, but I remember there were some interesting books and there were some not. And, Sean McKeever was in there, of course.
McKeever, yep. I would say if you look at the Tsunami line, I would guess that you would have to call McKeever the sort of breakout because Kirkman came to it sort of after. But after it had started to die, I believe he came in on one of the last titles there.
Okay.
But the real founding books there were Sentinel, which was McKeever, New Mutants, which was us, Namor, which was Bill Jemis.
Yeah, with Andy Watson?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, Andy got driven off that book quickly, right?
Yeah.
And it was just Bill writing it. And putting poetry in the back or something. That was a strange book.
It was. Well, and I think because everyone was expecting, all right, Namor, finally, you know, he's getting his own book. And it's like, we don't want 14-year-old Namor. What the hell is this?
Well, I think the thing that really killed that book, if I might be brutally honest, is this notion that they were going to apply this X-Men-esque level of persecution to all things from the ocean. So, like, in the very first issue, some kid sees a jellyfish, and they're like, all things from the ocean are bad and evil. I'm like, what the heck is this? Is this the world in which nobody eats fish? Sorry.
No, I like that.
It was weird. They tried to put that paradigm to sort of justify Namor's hostility. And, you know, we dump so much crap in the ocean. You know, oceans cover 3/4 of the planet, yet we don't acknowledge that they have any sovereignty over anything that goes on anywhere else. There's so many reasons to justify Namor being such a hard ass.
Oh, sure.
I don't think you need anti-seafood prejudice.
A common prejudice.
Oh, those 30s, they would persecute anything they could back in the 1930s, even fish. No, I understand. Well, let's talk a little bit more about the writing course because I guess you guys have a new semester, for lack of better words, coming up in the spring.
Well, this is just
term.
Me, because there's a bit of, I think, teaching stage fright that Christina is feeling. So I'm trying to get her to do an online course so that she doesn't have to get up there. And
I'm not good at standing in front of a group of people and
really?
Lecturing.
Oh, that's tough. Okay.
I'm shy.
Okay.
But no, so this is me, and this is at UCLA Extension. And it's an intro course to writing for sequential art, and I'm very happy to say this is my second time teaching it. I taught it last summer, and then again, this is the winter quarter that's going on. They do it on a quarterly system.
Okay.
And in both classes, the students have been saying, now teach us an intermediate or advanced course. And so there, strangely enough, I got sort of a class full of little Norma Rays as they are trying to organize and get the school to give them an intermediate course. And I've been pushing the school to do it. Now I'm going to step back and let the students do it because if they insist that they will pay for a class, then the school will offer the class.
Sure.
So, but right now I'm doing the winter quarter, and then in the spring I'm going to teach another intro. And I think that's what the school is waiting for, is for three times so I have a large pool of students to draw from, because if every student who said they'd take an intermediate course took one, they'd have done it already.
I see.
The school would have offered it already, but I think they have experience in this, and people say they'll do it, but then scheduling issues, financial issues, and they can't do it. So, but it's been fun.
13-week course? 13 weeks then?
10 weeks.
10 weeks, okay.
10 weeks, 10 three-hour sessions.
Okay. And I know a friend of mine took the course, and you guys had guest speakers at the course too,
yes.
You know, writers and...
We've had, I've had in both times I've taught it, and probably every time I teach it, he'll come again because he's that kind of dependable, Greg Rucka.
Okay.
The last time I had, and again this time, Jason DeAngelis, the publisher of Seven Seas Entertainment. They're a manga publisher that does original English language manga that Christine and I have written two books for them.
One was a pirate book, I know that.
Destiny's Hand.
Very cool. And what was the other one?
Amazing Agent Luna.
Very cool, yeah.
And so he comes in and sort of gives them a publisher's eye view, you know, what he's looking for in proposals, things like that. And then this coming week, end of this week, I should say, I didn't have him last time around, but I do this time, and I'm hoping to get him again later. James Lucas Jones, editor-in-chief at Oni Press, will be speaking to the class.
Oh, that's great.
And it's a good contrast because Jason DeAngelis at Seven Seas is heavily involved in the Hollywood side of his business as well. So he's always on the lookout for stories that have a film or a TV in them, you know, a TV show in them.
Okay.
Whereas James Lucas Jones's point of view is, you know, if you're looking for a TV show idea, work in TV. If you're looking for a comic book idea, you work in comics. And if you know, Miracle of Miracles, the company, the publisher, the writers, everyone, the artist can get money for a movie afterwards, that's great, but he never wants to throw out an idea just because it isn't Hollywood enough.
Okay.
So it's an interesting contrast in the perspectives.
It is, because I think a lot of the end results of Oni books do have the potential of being adapted into other things. We're seeing it now, obviously, with Whiteout, but I'd point to your stories as well. I think Three Strikes is a great crime story that I could easily see as an interesting movie, and I think Maria's Wedding would have still made a very interesting movie. The Tomb had you know, I mean, that's there, and I don't mean that in the crassest that you guys even, you know, thought of it as, you know, okay, you know, this is, you know, we'll get the comic book and then we'll get the movie and everything will be great. But why not? If, you know,
absolutely. You know. if a story presents itself,
yeah,
for it, you know, that's great, and it's wonderful to have sort of this second venue for it and everything.
Sure.
I think there's just the fear that if you're trying to sell a comic book and someone's going to dismiss it because it's not a good movie, then you start to worry where the lines blur. And
no, I can appreciate
it. Right,
well,
for example, Oni is making headway on the possibility of a Scott Pilgrim movie.
Okay.
Now, I've read Scott Pilgrim, and I was stunned to hear that it was going to be a movie. It's not very movie-like. It struck me as the kind of story that works best in comics. I think it's great someone wants to make a movie out of it. I think there's an audience for that kind of movie, but Hollywood doesn't normally go for that. They want high concept, and this is sort of entirely about a notion of a character,
mm-hmm,
who Scott Pilgrim is, and the story isn't linear in the way that Hollywood movies tend to need to be linear. It doesn't fall easily into a genre unless you consider slacker chic to be a genre these days. you know, so that's the beauty, is that I think if Oni were stopping stories at the door for not being Hollywood enough, they never would have made Scott Pilgrim. And it's funny because that's likely to become a movie now. So I think sometimes applying that logic ahead of time, you kill good stories that ultimately could get you money in an ancillary form as a TV show, a movie, a video game, whatever. I just think when people start thinking too much that way, they box themselves out, I think.
Okay. Nancy, you mentioned the detective story, and you guys both did a story for Wonder Woman 200?
Yeah. That was funny because we got to really play with Silver Age storytelling, and it was sort of a loving tribute to it, and it was mocking it at the same time.
which writer? Kaniger? When Kaniger was writing Wonder Woman, or?
I'm trying to remember the writer. The whole era where, you know, Wonder Woman is being dragged across the sky by El Gaucho, you know, like that whole era.
Okay.
But even earlier than that too, when she and Ivan Cohen was the editor, and he sent us back a note going, you have to make reference to her magnetic hearing. And I was like, wow, I don't even remember that. What the heck is magnetic hearing? Does that even make sense?
I guess that's like, yeah. Well, we need some like telescopic vision, magnetic hearing, good enough.
Right. Well, we had fun with that one because we just got to cut loose and have a good time.
And one of my favorite stupid movies is called Amazon Women on the Moon.
I love that movie, absolutely.
And so we just decided, what if Wonder Woman encounters a race of Amazons on the moon? And so we entitled the story Amazon Women on the Moon, and it was just the whole thing plays towards a gag at the end. And I remember the very first, because I am so guilty of looking up reviews on the internet when I shouldn't. Very first review I found of that, literally the reviewer said that the story was so awful that whoever was responsible, and the reviewer didn't even bother to check that there were two of us, which would make what he was about to suggest anatomically impossible, but we were to have a spear shoved up our ass for writing it. And I thought,
Jesus.
This is the quality of online criticism.
Well, you don't have to worry. I don't do reviews here.
So. I think, you know, there's a danger in internet reviews. The one danger, it's like a double-edged sword. The danger is to assume that just because someone publishes it on the internet, they are qualified to review. But the other side of it is the danger is in assuming that just because it's on the internet, they are not qualified to review it. So you have to pick and choose and start seeing, just like with film critics, except with a broader base to pick from, you just have to see whose tastes match yours and then go check their reviews for stuff.
No, I hear you.
And then ignore everything else. And, you know, if a reviewer wants to suggest physical torture on a writer, that's probably good criteria to stop reading the reviews.
Excuse me. I know and enjoyed when you guys filled in on Checkmate, and I really enjoyed that story, and it was great to see that was one of the first sightings of the Suicide Squad coming back.
Yeah, that was funny because we were pushing for the Suicide Squad for how long before we got that?
Well, it was 6 months, a year or something.
Right after Identity Crisis, there was the Rogue War in the Flash books, and the combination of the two stories began to create a vibe in DC that no villains had reformed without either Zatanna mind-wiping them or the Top doing some version of the same.
Okay.
And so we started to go, you don't want that. You want the possibility for redemption. You just want it to be really hard. And the best book to illustrate that was always The Suicide Squad.
Oh, yeah.
So we started going sort of door-to-door at DC saying, let us do The Suicide Squad. You need this book right now because you're creating a feeling that villains always stay evil unless somebody does something magical to them. And we went to DiDio. We went, and he said, that's a pretty good point. And it just sort of died there. We went to various editors, Eddie Braganza, and everybody seemed to agree with our point, but nobody could figure out what to do, because I guess they were trying to let some time pass from the previous incarnation of the Suicide Squad, which hadn't sold all that well and got canceled.
That was, Keith Giffen's, where it was like, they thought it was Sergeant Rock, and it really wasn't, and it was nothing like the Ostrander book of the 80s.
Well, I like Keith's stuff, I did read it, and I did like that book, but I did understand that they wanted to let some time pass because they basically had the product out and it had failed, at least commercially. Because I really don't want to speak ill of Keith Giffen.
Oh, no, I understand.
Tremendously.
I'm a big fan.
So, finally, as with many things in our career, we were assisted by a timely intervention from Greg, who said, Joan Hilty is the editor you want to speak to. This is right up her alley. We went to Joan, and she started talking about the possibility of a Suicide Squad miniseries, but then came back to us with the same, we don't know about the timing because this other book, so here's our compromise. How about in Checkmate? And Greg said, and I'll bring them on to co-write it. So this was not a case of Greg not making his schedule where we were brought in to assist. This was a case of we had a story we desperately wanted to tell in D.C., and the best place for it was in his book, and he graciously sort of let us co-write those issues to get that story told.
That's really cool. Very cool.
You know, the later stuff when we jumped in and helped on the fire arc, that was because Greg was, sort of, I think, hip-deep in 52 and things and needed an assist, and he knew that I was a huge fan of Justice League International and of Fire, so he thought we were the right fit for that story.
That was a really cool backstory. Yeah, I enjoyed that. It kind of promoted Fire from just being the hottie, the Brazilian hottie that she is, and it gave her a very three-dimensional backstory that was very, very cool. So nice going on that as well. I forgot about that. That's really neat. Are there, Joan? Everyone who works for Joan Hilty loves Joan Hilty.
And she's that's amazing.
Good. You know, she must be.
Joan is amazing. I think, you know, our time at Checkmate with the Suicide Squad story, I think at the end of the day, Joan thought that our writing style didn't mesh with the book as well as we thought it did. I think she wanted someone who was better almost at the kind of stuff Greg specializes in, the well-researched...
The spy espionage.
Spy jargon that sounds really authentic. we got in both the stories we came in on, we got to do more superhero take. We got to do the Suicide Squad, and it was much more about witty banter than it was about geopolitics. You know, we dove into Myanmar and all of that. But and I think that Joan is trying to find a book for us that better suits our voice. And so she brought when Greg needed more help on the book, she went to Eric Trautman, whose voice I think meshes much more organically with Greg.
Okay.
But that notwithstanding, we would work for Joan Hilty again in a heartbeat because that's not something that we take personally. That's her trying to match the writers to the tone of the book, which, frankly, is her job.
Certainly.
It's interesting because I think there are so many editors in comics. They get so slammed and overworked that I think a lot of times they're just playing gatekeeper, trying to make sure the trains run on time and the pages get turned in and everything makes it to the printer. Joan, I've always felt, is one of the few editors we've worked with who really gives story notes, and you're really discussing story with her and feeling like you're much more focused on the creative process.
Joan's the one who would say things like, I'm sorry if this sounds overly harsh, guys, and we would cite our time on our list and say, this really isn't that harsh. Because there are a lot of editors who, because they're so swamped, so long as you don't really screw up, they just sort of let it go through.
Okay.
And then only afterwards when they go, oh, crap, that doesn't match with the book that's coming out this week, they start turning around and changing it. She's involved at a much earlier stage, so she gets, I think, what she wants more effectively than any other editor we've worked with at the Big Two.
I got you. That's cool.
I think sometimes editors are scared of provoking the beast that is a writer's ego. But it's funny, you'll talk to successful writers like Greg, semi-successful ones like us, at least at Marvel and DC, we're only semi-successful.
I understand.
And almost everyone will tell you they would give their right arm for an editor who got hip deep in the story with them. Agree or disagree with them. If they're willing to give you a back and forth, it's going to make the story better.
I always wonder if at the smaller publishers, if, you know, in a lot of cases, especially in creator-owned books, when you are self-editing, if that's even more challenging. So who in of the writing team would you say, like, you know, Christina, are you the gatekeeper, you think, because of you at the typewriter and stuff? Or, you know, Nuncy, is it you when you're, you know, or just depends situationally?
I'm not sure you could say there's any one gatekeeper. There's always the sense that each of us, when we've written something, the other one, you know, takes a look. We each have to take our pass and go, okay, you know, and sort of give it that final approval or point out something that's like, no, this is still a problem spot. We have to work on this. And
well,
okay.
There was a thing, you know, like Robert would say this on our list all the time. Let's put a pin in it and come back to it later. Christina and I, not because that was particularly traumatic at our list, but we make a rule out of when we write, we never do that. So we will hover on one page and go back and forth until both of us are happy.
Okay.
So by the time we get a first draft out, it's usually a fourth or fifth draft because every line, every panel, if I'm on a roll sort of just talking about what I think is going to happen, she's going to stop me at every line she has a problem with. She's going to stop me at every, you know, pacing decision that she has a problem with. And then when she turns around and says, no, I want to do it this way, if I don't like that, then we're going to keep going back and forth until we get it. And there are times when she'll say, no, I know how I want to do this scene, and she'll just type it all up, and then I get to come over to the computer and tell her why that's
Suck.
No, I mean, but there's that back and forth. So we are, I think, gatekeeper to each other.
Okay.
But if you ask who is the gatekeeper more often, I think it's her, because she's a more meticulous person than I am. She doesn't tend to type it until she's ready. I will go with a thought and just keep barreling forward until I get to the end of a page and go, well, that just took me down the wrong place, and it sucks. She won't. She'll stop it at panel one until she knows it's going where she wants it to go. So I think she...
So you're saying I slow us down is what you're saying.
I'm saying you're the editor of the piece.
Now,
it's great because writing together, we don't fight about things like, you know, who didn't put the cap on the toothpaste. All of the biggest fights in our marriage have been writing fights.
Well, that's what I was going to ask, and I don't want to, you know, I'm not looking for dirt, but, I mean, is there, you know, have there been story points where it's like, okay, I guess I'll be sleeping on my side of the bed even more tonight than normally or whatever. I mean,
not,
you know.
Not recently, but we have had some big ones.
We've had some brutal ones, but in the end, like any marriage, I think when we get into the brutal fights, we wind up fighting about how we fight, not about the... So we'll disagree on a thing in the story, and then I'll be snotty about it, or she'll be passive-aggressive about it, or she'll be sarcastic about it, or I'll be just plain old mean, or whatever. And then we'll be arguing about why did you have to be so mean about that. And that's when those things go out of control. And then when we work that stuff out, we go, oh, yeah, and about that panel. And by the time we sort out that fight, it's really easy to fix the panel or the page or the plot point.
That's cool.
So I can't think of any plot points that in and of themselves cause stuff. It's just, it's once we start going, we can, you know, roll off a cliff, I think.
Well, that's cool. Because, you know, I think of Brian Azzarello and Jill Thompson, who, you know, it's like, so are you guys ever going to write and do a book together? Like, nope. And it's like, okay. It's like, all right, there you go.
I'd actually say we complement each other really well. It's worked out very well as a writing partnership. Nanthea's got such a better head for plotting than I do.
Okay.
I can get so sort of, I would never even get out of the gate being sort of traumatized with going, but I don't know what to have happen next. And he's sort of good at coming up with the big ideas. And then I jump in and help fill in the steps along the way and go, okay, so this is how we'll get there.
That's cool. Is there, and I don't want to spoil any potential pitches to either of the big two, but are there characters that you would be willing to name that you haven't had a chance to write that you, oh, man, if, you know.
Well, we have, I think, one of the worst horror stories about trying to get a specific book with a specific character. Like, we have been trying to get Zatanna for forever. We went to them, again, in the wake of Identity Crisis, mm-hmm. We went to them and we pitched a retelling of Zatanna year one type story. We weren't calling it at the time, but it was a retelling of the original search for her father.
Classic Silver Age story that, yeah.
Right. But we looked at the cast list and realized everyone that she dealt with, every hero she dealt with in that quest, was a huge part of Identity Crisis. It was Batman. It was Elongated Man.
Mm-hmm.
It was the Atom. I mean, these were the heroes she was dealing with. So we thought, let's retell it for this sort of post-crisis continuity and put in story elements that really tie into Identity Crisis.
That's cool.
So we had this whole story where it's like her first meeting with all these heroes, the basis of all of their relationships, and even included the first time she ever had to take someone's memory away, the first time she had to use her magic to do that.
Okay.
And we had worked Dr. Light as one of the villains into the story, and this was the really sadistic one, not the incompetent one, because
sure.
It was before any of that other stuff.
Sure.
So we did that, and we pitched it to Dan DiDio.
Mm-hmm.
And Dan said, I really like that. I have another pitch in about a young Zatanna, but I really like that story. So let me see, because that pitch is Paul Dini.
Sure.
Well, you know, in the contest...
You can't really argue with that, you know.
Yeah.
Paul Dini's going to win.
Contest between us and Paul Dini. Who do you think they're going to want to publish a book by?
I understand.
Particularly a book about Zatanna. So, but he really liked the idea. He said, you know what, get it to an editor. And told us an editor whose name we're leaving out of this story because we like this editor personally, but they didn't do particularly well by us in this particular case. They didn't read it, ever.
Oh.
And there were other ideas we were developing with that editor, good ideas that we were very excited about, but the editor kept saying, let's focus on this, let's focus on that. And it was like, let's focus on Steele. And then Steele got pulled into 52, so no one else could write him. So our Steele pitch just went away. And we turned around and said, what about Zatanna? And the editor said, oh, yeah, I never read that. And then didn't. A couple months later, we're hearing from Jen Van Meter that Dan is on a year one. Dan DiDio is on a year one kick. He wants to do a lot of year ones and retell the origins based on current chronology. And he was talking to Jen and saying, here are some of the characters I want to do. Black Lightning, and that was the one that led to Jen getting the Black Lightning year one that she's working on now.
Yes.
And Zatanna. And so Jen called us and said, didn't you guys pitch effectively Zatanna year one? And we said, yeah. And she said, because Dan DiDio just asked me to pitch it.
Oh, boy.
And this was about 2 weeks before we were supposed to go to New York to visit my family. So we go into D.C. We mentioned to Dan. We say, well, we're here. You're looking for year ones. What about the Zatanna pitch we pitched you last year at the con? And Dan looks at us. He goes, that's why Jen looked at me like I had two heads. So he says, okay, pitch it again. Redo it as a year one. And, you know, we said, look, we did it last time, and it never made its way back to you because the editor never read it. And he said, don't give it to any editor. Give it to me.
Okay.
And so we went home, and we reworked it, and we were all excited. And we should have known Dan DiDio is the busiest man in DC Comics. So the idea that he was going to do this himself, we should have realized was completely ludicrous. So we send it to him, and he goes, yes, I've assigned it to an editor. And it's the same editor.
Oh, no.
And the editor says, let's not focus on Zatanna. Okay. Let's focus on Wonder Girl.
Oh, God.
So we work on a Wonder Girl pitch, and literally every 2 weeks, like clockwork, say, have you read the Zatanna pitch yet? And every email about the Zatanna pitch, no answer. Every email about Wonder Woman, answer. I mean, Wonder Girl, answer. Then the Wonder Girl pitch goes away because Dan's like, nobody wants a miniseries about Wonder Girl.
Jeez.
So we turn around and we say, what about Zatanna year one? And the editor says, the ship has sailed on year one. It's too late. Having not read it for another year.
Oh, my God. Wow.
So you ask us if there's a character we want to write? There are a lot of characters that we have a lot of love for that we would love to write. Zatanna is only one of them. But because of this and how long it's been, it would be a huge personal triumph if we could get this.
Someday, 20 years from now, we will be writing this Zatanna story.
Jeez. No,
and, you know, the sad thing is the editor in question likes us and has tried to develop stuff with us before, and we really like this editor. But I don't think the editor is a fan of Zatanna.
I see.
And so it was just a question that Dan kept matching it up with the wrong person. And the person was also remarkably busy. So in terms of development, you know, they were only going to develop the pitches that they really had an emotional investment in.
Wow.
So.
Well, I have, if it's any consolation, I've heard similar stories at both companies, and I'll leave it at that. So,
you know,
from other writers. So
this is the nature of the business. I don't recite that story as a way of saying, you know, God damn them all, it sucked.
No, I understand.
It's just, you know,
the war stories that you get.
Yeah. And, you know, if we were, you know, we do a lot of Oni books that we're very proud of, and Oni loves us, and we can sort of get anything going there. But at DC and Marvel, you know, we recognize our profile is not the same. You know, were we bigger names, I don't think this process would take quite as long. But for anyone at our level at those publishers, this is what you have to go through. You know, this is the process. It takes a while to get something up and moving. And often by the time it gets up and moving, its window of opportunity, its moment has passed.
Well, and I appreciate that because I, I, I do think listeners of Word Balloon do kind of come sometimes to get real tips from pros, and I think that's a very honest story. And again, as you say, told with you know, without any malice intended, but just to show that these are two big machines in DC and Marvel, and they are constantly running, and there are so many editors and so many writers and so many big picture things that a great idea can slip through like that.
Well, I'm not going to be the one to say it's a great idea.
I'll
because
say.
That would be pompous.
I'll say it.
It certainly was one that we were enthusiastic about, and it was one that seemed every time that it went to Dan DiDio, who is the sort of
he was enthusiastic about it.
He seemed very genuinely enthusiastic about it. You know, he never got to read the full pitch, so Lord only knows whether he would have been happy with our take on it. But mm-hmm. the take that we would give him in face-to-face discussions, he always responded very well to. And that's just that's unfortunate that the filters that are in place take so long sometimes that Dan, who has so many things on his plate, has to move on before it gets to him.
And this story is not yet over, actually. We found another editor who is willing to take a look at the idea, not as a year one now. It would be sort of retooled back to its initial context that was set in. But we do have another editor who's interested in looking at it.
Which is a reminder to us that we need to retool that and get it off.
I can appreciate a possible trepidation just because she isn't, like, you know, an obvious choice. And I mean, it's an easy sell from an art standpoint, because you got the hottie and the fishnets and everything, and there's nothing wrong. I mean, that's what. Hey,
I'll fess up to that being my primary interest.
Well, hey, man, we're for Black Canary. Why not? There's a reason why she's back in the costume now. So
yeah, but Black Canary is a favorite around here, but not just from my point of view, but from Christina's.
Love Black Canary.
If you wanted a short list of characters that we really want to write, Black Canary would be on both of our lists, but particularly on hers.
That's cool.
Booster Gold would be on mine.
Very cool.
As Christina said, I have a love of the old 80s DC that had a certain humor to it, the mid-80s stuff. The Booster Gold, Blue Beetle, Blue Devil, like that era stuff really speaks to me.
Sure.
Perhaps because I was 15 at the time.
Well, I was reading that stuff, too. What do you think of what Jeff is doing, right? And I don't mean to, like, you know, call you on or anything. I mention it because I really do think it's one of the better books out there that DC is doing.
I think it's one of the strongest books DC is publishing right now. I think the danger with a book like that is always because of time travel and alternate futures and the changing of history, that it runs the risk of being awfully confusing and very sort of comic geek heavy, and I think Jeff's done a wonderful job of avoiding those problems and making it sort of accessible and humorous, which I think Booster Gold needs to be accessible and humorous.
I agree. And again, comedy's a tough sell, I think, to today's reader.
And I think Jeff has packaged it brilliantly by making it about someone's trying to wipe out the Justice League before they become the Justice League. By making the stakes appear really grave, he can slip in all the humor he wants that fits with the character, because it's not just a throwaway funny book. It's dealing with the continuity of the DC universe itself. So no one at DC, none of the fans who might say that humor is frivolous can just disregard it. It has a certain importance, particularly with that character coming out of 52, that allows him to play it humorous and keep the stakes raised anyway.
And Christina is someone who didn't grow up reading comic books. Who are the mainstream stars that interest you?
I'm a big Batman fan.
Okay.
I love the whole Bat family. I love Nightwing. I love...
She really loves Nightwing.
Thank you. you know, Oracle, the Huntress, that whole group there. As I said before, I love Black Canary. Trying to think who else is out there. It's funny, having spent, you know, most of the years working actually at Marvel, I'm more familiar with the DC characters.
I was going to ask, yeah.
But I love the X-Men, you know. There's always so many interesting stories that you can tell with the X-Men and you know, different ways to explore and, you know, and find new takes on them and everything.
Well, we at Marvel, we had a chance very briefly to pitch, after a conversation with Joe Quesada, a radically different take on Iron Man. Joe was basically saying, we need to do something to shake up the character. And we, you know, you talk about, like, we went radical in one direction, and Marvel just decided to go another.
Okay.
They've, you know, given him all sorts of questions of, you know, what's he doing? Is he good? Is he bad? All of these things that are coming out of the continuity now.
Mm-hmm.
That was the way they chose to take him. We chose to kill him.
Wow.
We chose to kill Tony, have him die while in the armor, after having enhanced the armor with a neural interface so that he became the ghost in the machine for whoever wore the armor next. Tony's sentience would be inside the machine advising him.
Wow.
And we went with Iron Man being replaced by a woman.
Oh, wow.
So it would be a woman wearing the armor, but no one would suspect it because it still looks like the old armor. And Tony's in the machine trying to tell her how to go forward and what to do.
Oh, that's really interesting.
We went completely radical. So on some level, there's a part of me that wishes we could get our hands on Iron Man because I feel like we had an opportunity to do something groundbreaking and probably much reviled.
Well, you really want to piss him off, put Pepper Potts in the armor.
That wasn't who we went with, thanks. We pitched a 12-issue arc in which Tony is dying.
Okay.
And he goes to all of these experts to try and it's sort of like if he comes out of the armor, he's less functional, but he will live.
Okay.
If he stays in the armor, he will be fully functional, but he's speeding up his own demise. And he chooses to go out as Iron Man. He chooses to stay in the armor, fight the fight, and die. But he goes to every major scientific figure in the Marvel Universe for help. And what we would do is, among the Reed Richards and Dr. Dooms of the world, we would create a robotics genius that he consults, and that was her. And she would be the only one who's willing to help him.
Oh, that's cool.
And so when he dies, she takes the armor.
Wow.
So we would have spent 12 issues creating this character and having the readers think that she was going to be the one who saves Tony.
That's really cool.
She winds up the one replacing him.
Man. Well, as you said, I think the villagers would probably call for your heads, but I think it's really cool. That's a cool story. See, that's the thing. I'm too old. Nothing phases me. One more day didn't piss me off. It didn't, you know, it didn't ruin my childhood or whatever. I'm always interested in different takes, and that's why I enjoyed What If as I in the 80s and even the newer versions, and also, you know, Elseworlds and stuff. I always think you can't, you know, let's break the, you know, mold every now and then and tell a radically different story. So, you know,
I
even as an alternate universe, it would have been an interesting story.
I think in retrospect, the only thing that I look back at that story idea and think probably wouldn't have worked is that right now I'm worried that the big two publishers are relying almost a little too much on death.
Sure, sure.
And I wouldn't have wanted to tell that story in an era where it seemed like a lot of "you'll never believe who dies in this shocking next issue" sort of happens over and over again.
What do you guys think of the events that have been going on lately at the big two?
I think that I worry that the readers will get event fatigue.
I keep saying the same thing, and
and it's never happening. So I think we might both be wrong.
Okay.
But I think if you look at DC, they have been telling one giant whole, you know, shared universe story since Identity Crisis.
Yep.
And Marvel's been doing it since Avengers Disassembled.
Yeah.
And I worry that with the cost of comics being what they are, tying all the books into this, which fortunately I think both publishers have been smart enough to not make every book tied to them, but still the high percentage of books that are affected by these stories, it makes it hard for a reader who doesn't have a lot of money to follow these large stories without buying ancillary titles that tie in. So you look at the changes that are going on in the X books now, and you look at their promises that you won't have to pick up every book of, you know, after Messiah Complex, which was running through every book,
mm-hmm.
That now Divided We Fall is going to allow you to buy one book and not another. I think that that's the right way to relieve the event fatigue, is let the people who don't want to be in on this big stuff buy the books they love and keep reading them. And I think as long as they tread that line carefully, they will avoid event fatigue. And they've done a great job avoiding event fatigue so far. People seem excited for the, you know, the secret invasion, and they seem excited for the final crisis. And so you can't knock it if it's stirring up enthusiasm. But that's been my fear, is that they're going to hit some saturation point and interest is going to drop off.
What do you think, Christina? I'm curious. I'm sorry, Nuns. I didn't mean to.
It hasn't happened yet, so I could just be being paranoid.
And you're a newer reader, Christina. I mean, Nuns and I go back to the 80s and earlier in my case. I mean, I go back to 12 cent days and stuff. So what do you think? I mean, do you get tired of big events, or, I mean, how do you feel about it?
I would say that I agree with a lot of what Nuncio says, you know, other than the very practical concern of, you know, how many titles you can afford to buy each month. I think there is also the sense of, you know, when something big happens, that's cool, and it's this event, and you're looking forward to it. And it's almost like if every day is Christmas, you don't get the break in between to then look forward to the next one. So,
sure.
You know, from a creative point of view, that would be my fear, too, that you almost want to let things slow down a little bit and within their own titles have the excitement and the drama and everything that's going on, and then have that big swell and the big thing that brings everybody together again be a little bit more spaced out.
I also think it's very striking that both universes have gotten so dark. I mean, if you look at the ideas central to Marvel, they've essentially debunked superheroes. With this registration thing, they've basically said the world would not accept costumed, superpowered people helping you out of the goodness of their heart. The world would have forced them to be held accountable. That's a pretty dark point of view. It's probably very realistic, but the problem is it's so realistic that it may make it hard to go back to that idea later. And then if you look at DC, it's really dark. Like, the villains are winning all the time. Heroes are dying all the time. People are getting ripped in half. I think that in addition to event fatigue, I'm worried they're going to get hit by darkness fatigue, that the good guys need to win at some point. And the problem with one event after another is any triumph is short-lived because you know suspense is coming right back for the next event. So how do they win if this segues into another event? We just know that the odds just got harder, you know, or everything gets stacked even in higher for them to hurdle. And there's no place, as Christina says, there's no Christmas. At the end of Crisis on Infinite Earths, things got to be rebuilt, and we got to see the, for better or worse, the birthing pains of the new DC universe. And there was a joy to exploring that.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't get that because right after they win one battle, something else happens. So.
Yeah. No, I hear what you're saying. Well, and I feel like, and I apologize because I look and see that we have been talking for 90 minutes. I was going to.
That's Nunzio's fault.
Yeah, no.
I was going to say we can do that, but I can do that. I can just keep going. So.
Well, I want to ask, like, what is coming up for you guys? I mean, Jumper is currently out, and certainly all the Oni books are out there for people to pick up and in nice little trades. And
As we've sort of been saying, the getting of work at DC and Marvel has not been the smoothest right now, perhaps because I talk too much. But Oni's got a fairly full plate for us. We went over with James Lucas Jones the pitches that we have in with them, and discovered that they numbered 7.
Wow.
7 ideas that we want to do with them that James, at least, is excited and on board for. And
great.
Most of which the rest of Oni seems on board for. Right now, the first order of business is a sequel to Past Lives.
Cool.
Which is entitled All Saints Day, which, if scheduling goes well, will be out by All Saints Day, but it may be a little while after that because it's been a lot of actual research into saints.
Okay.
And my religious background, it could be best described as lapsed, so I have to re-immerse.
We've also got a new artist for All Saints Day because Chris Minton is now hard at work on Wasteland, and our artist is the father of triplets.
Oh, my.
So he's got his hands full as well.
Wow.
So that's one. The other idea that we're pitching right now is, like I said, there are about 7, but the one that we're probably going to move forward on next is a medical horror idea. And until the Oni guys give a direct approval of the idea, I don't want to talk more about it.
Okay.
But medical horror sort of House X-Files.
That's cool. Boy, medicine is an area that really hasn't been tabbed much in, as far as comic books in a long time. It's funny, even Marvel bringing back Night Nurse, and there's been very little medicine in Night Nurse. So,
yeah, this is true. We have the final volumes of our two Seven Seas OEL manga.
Cool.
Destiny's Hand and Amazing Agent Luna. We're about halfway through writing Destiny's Hand 3. When it's done, then they're going to put out a collected edition of all three volumes.
That's great.
As our sort of definitive pirate work.
Very cool.
Because everybody should have a definitive pirate work.
Nothing wrong with that. That's that's what the Watchmen tells us. There's always room for pirate stories. That's all right.
Even in the middle of a completely different story.
Exactly.
But, and then Luna is its fifth and final volume, so we'll be wrapping up what we hope will be the first Luna story, Amazing Agent Luna story. And then because... It's funny how the world works. You know, we were trying to walk the line between film and TV and comics,
mm-hmm.
but as film and TV sort of dried up for us, we became pretty much comics exclusive writers.
Okay.
And as things are sort of drying up at Marvel and DC, and we could do all these ideas with Oni, but you know, you can't make a living on Oni wages. Just as that starts to dry up, as fortune would have it, we're back in the Hollywood game. So we have two feature films, feature scripts that have been optioned.
Oh, that's great.
One of which we think even has an outside chance of being made.
Very cool.
And we have the TV movie that Christina mentioned, the country western. It's a romantic comedy set in the country music business.
And what channel is that going to be on?
It's going to be on Oxygen.
Okay.
It's at the early stages. We sold the idea just before the writer's strike, and so then we were racing to get the paperwork signed before the strike. And then when the strike happened, there was a buyout of Oxygen. So all the execs have changed over there.
Oh, okay.
So we're waiting to see who our exec's going to be and their level of enthusiasm for the project. We're hoping that it gets right back on track and keeps going, but so it may be a while before this comes to Oxygen, but we're pretty hopeful that it will. And more importantly, it's gotten us back in the TV business, which is a fun place to be.
That's cool. Is there a was Oxygen bought by a larger conglomerate? Which who owns Oxygen now?
I believe it's NBC Universal.
Oh, okay. Well, that's
so
cool.
So that will keep the network around and solvent and stable for a while. But
sure.
I think, you know, who knows if they come out of this going, we want to do all reality television. Who knows, you know?
Wow.
The producer that we're doing this with has done a couple of TV movies with Oxygen before, and those have been fairly highly rated and well-received over at Oxygen. So
cool.
We think even if they're going to diminish their scripted material, they'll probably keep working with those guys.
Very cool.
Which means that this idea should hopefully stay afloat, but
we'll see. You never know.
Yeah,
the strike changes everything, and so we're just happy it's over so we can get back to work as soon as this project gets rolling again.
Well, that's cool. Well, I think you guys write very, like I said before, very interesting characters, and I think a lot of your plot ideas are really interesting too. So, you know, good luck with more TV work, and I'm glad Oni still likes your stuff, and I have a feeling that hopefully the wiser heads will prevail at DC and Marvel, and we'll see more mainstream stuff from you guys as well, because you're a fun writing team.
Thank you. I
kind of came in the side way. I Three Strikes was the first exposure to your work, and then I went from there and saw some of the Marvel and DC stuff, and I was always interested in what you guys were doing with Oni, but. Very cool. Good luck with Jumper, and good luck with the
I forgot the other thing.
Please.
And the Jumper DVD.
Yes.
We'll have the original comic on the Jumper DVD that will further explore the connection between David and his mother.
There you go.
hopefully add a little bit more to the character of David.
And then hopefully that franchise might continue, and
We hope it does, because there's so much potential to it, and we'd like to stay involved in it in whatever role they'll have us, because, you know, in exploring these sort of side stories, we really got to see what you could do with this franchise.
Very cool. Well, thanks for a very involved discussion, honestly. I mean, once you say you blather too much, but no. It's I always welcome tangents on Word Balloon, and we touched a lot of interesting subjects, and I think we got into some interesting points about craft. Good luck with the class as well. That's at UCLA?
Yeah, UCLA Extension.
Okay.
Which I will plug here, www.uclaextension.edu. And if you look, it is in the English department, number 409.2, so if you're in Los Angeles, come and see if you want to sign up for a class and learn how to write comics.
They seem to know what they're doing, folks. I would take them up on it. So. Thank you very much for your time, guys.
Thanks a lot, John.
Good stuff from Nunzio De Filippis and Christina Weir. Make sure you check out all their upcoming projects from Oni and Seven Seas. And, of course, look for the Jumper DVD. That'll do it for this edition of Word Balloon. Thanks a lot for listening. This is John Suntress. Don't forget, you can find Word Balloon all over the Internet. We're at Newsarama.com, also iTunes. You can find us on our MySpace page, myspace.com/wordballoon, our ComicSpace page, comicspace.com/wordballoon. And, as always, you can reach me via email, john@wordballoon.com. Good things coming up in the month of April. Make sure you stay with us here at Word Balloon. Until next time, Word Balloon is a copyright feature of Shaky Productions, copyright 2008.